2024. Welcome, everyone. Today, we're going to listen to platform priorities of a number of groups, individuals that are here today. And we have approximately 18 or so that are on the agenda. We've asked them to limit testimony to about 7 minutes to provide an overview and also a one-page summary if they have that, and that'll be distributed as they do their testimony. Many of you have had the opportunity to meet with these individuals, and you will see more of them, but we thought it would be helpful just to get a big picture perspective from the various groups from throughout our state. So with that, we're going to go in the order that's listed on the agenda, and I'm going to ask people to come up in threesomes. And so we have Mr. Aronson, Brad Lundell, and Mary Gilbert. And if each of you are here, please approach, and if not, if we don't have three, then Margot Balk would be next from the school business. But it looks like we're all here. And as always, please state your name for the record, your organization. And for members, today we will actively listen, and there will be a chance for questions and dialogue as we progress during the session. So, welcome, Mr. Aronson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Roger Aronson. I represent the Elementary Principals Association and the Secondary School Principals Association. The Elementary Association has 750 elementary principals throughout Minnesota. The Secondary Association has about 1,200 members. These are principals and assistant principals. They cover almost every public school in Minnesota. I suspect it's fair to say that probably every member of this committee has principals in your districts that belong to these two state associations. We actively lobby here at the Capitol, while we're going to spend 7 minutes with these two associations telling you a little bit about their priorities for the year, you might know that they spend quite a bit of time actually putting these priorities together and internal discussion and what issues interest them for the upcoming session. You might notice through the, excuse me, Mr. Chair, the two documents that I've given you that some of these are policy matters as well. They're drafted both, I think, in mind for this committee and for the policy issues that you face during the 2013 school year. Let me talk a little bit about the key legislative priorities for the secondary principals on the list that they put here. And some of this actually fits in quite nicely with the preliminary discussions you've heard about the governor's budget. QCOMP is on the list here. QCOMP is a teacher-developed program. Technically, when it was put together, it doesn't include principals. And through our legislative agendas for the last several years, we've had this on here, that principals be included in the staff development components of QCOMP as well. We are very interested in seeing that districts that don't get QCOMP and QCOMP monies and whatever monies may be available that would help districts, be extended to districts, to help in the development and enhancement of the teacher and principal evaluation processes that are going into effect. As you all know, in 13-14, the statewide mandate for principal evaluation goes into effect, and then 14-15, the statewide mandate for teacher evaluation goes into effect. The second list on the secondary agenda there is, this is a program that was passed a couple of years ago. This also, there's a provision of this that it appears in the governor's budget, but it has to do with early graduation from high school. It used to be that if a student graduated early from high school, you got the foundation aid for the balance of the school year. 2 years ago, in a program that was initiated in the House, some scholarships were created, and there was an attempt to divert that money when kids were graduating early into this scholarship program. The diversion didn't work very well. Last year, we actually cut the funding when kids graduate early. And one of the things that happens with that, this varies from district to district, but you might have a district that has 30 early graduations in it. If you take 30 times half the foundation aid for a year for kids that graduate early, that's a significant hit on a site-by-site basis. It costs about $1 million a year, and we'd like to see that reinstated, that we get the foundation aid for the year. And then we don't give kids a disincentive from graduating early. We have some interest in online learning, the policy parameters about that. You're going to hear this year about the Principals Academy. This is a program that originated in the Senate some years ago to develop solid leadership skills, and the program has been housed at the University of Minnesota. The funding on that program went away, and the program actually was significantly changed. There's a group that is circulating a proposal to reinstate that. We'd ask you to look at that very closely. It's been very successful, and it's had a lot of support from several school districts. You are going to hear a lot about bullying this year. There was a bullying task force, and the task force's recommendations, whether it's bullying, whether it's testing, whether it's the school finance, carry a lot of weight, both with the department, with members, and we had members of our organizations on these. We'd like you to look at the bullying proposals to talk about programming. School principals in both the elementary and the secondary associations feel very strongly that if we're going to talk about changing kids' behavior, we need programs. And we have a little theme that we use with that called programs, not paperwork. And you'll hear more about that as we talk about that. And we look forward to working with the department, with you, with Senator Dibble, and others on in that particular area. But we need program, and some of these programs are quite expensive. The Olveus program is a very popular one in Minnesota, and again, it's something that you need to look at. And Mr. Chairman, you and I have actually spoken about that privately. We're very interested on the elementary side on all-day K. Next week, and as you see on our all-day K brochure, Joey Page is listed here, and Joey Page is the president-elect. I always kind of tease Joey about how do you strike terror into the hearts of children as a principal with a name like Joey. But you will meet Joey next week. Senator Claussen has asked him to come in and testify on the Senator Claussen's proposal, and he'll be here next week. You'll hear from him. I've included the And we do this traditionally, but the names of our committee members and our officers are on these documents. You'll see these people from time to time. Paul Neubauer, who's with the secondaries, testified earlier in the week in the House on the testing task force. And again, you'll hear from Joey Page next week. Anytime you want to talk to any of our people about any educational issues, we are available to talk to you. We want to be a resource. We want to help shape the decisions as you make them here, Mr. Chair. So I hope I haven't gone over my 7 minutes. I did lobby with your committee administrator that I should get 14 because I had the two. She told me I was lucky to have the seven. So,
we're honored to have you lead off the presentation.
So. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you very much. Brad Lundell.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Brad Lundell with Schools for Equity and Education. I have some documents to hand out. Schools for Equity and Education has been around in one form or another for the last 34 years. I've been with the organization for 20 years, the last 12 as executive director. We are an organization of 62 school districts located throughout the state, both metropolitan and non-metropolitan districts. The binding principle that brings us all together is the fact we have low property wealth per pupil. And the when property taxes get into the system, we are at a distinct disadvantage trying to raise money through the referendum, debt service levies. Other levies also affect our taxpayers more adversely than they do in districts that have high concentrations of commercial industrial property. We work mostly with funding. We do work policy. Policy and funding often go together, and we do work with some policy issues as well. Just briefly, there's a one page here that kind of distills our platform down into bullet points. The two things in the equity portion of our platform we're talking about is reestablishment of the general education levy and also the improvement of the equalizing factors for the referendum and debt service programs. I should also add any program or any levy that's not equalized, like the Safe Schools levy, the lease levy, levies with low equalization factors like the deferred maintenance levy and the QCOMP levy would also be things that we would like to discuss. We have a number of districts that are participating in those programs, and again, when you have low property wealth, you're at a disadvantage compared to districts with high property wealth when you're trying to raise that money. In terms of the adequacy portion of the platform, the increase in the general education basic formula is very important. For us, we're not districts that generate a lot of money through categorical programs. We do have some districts that have high levels of that have relatively high levels of compensatory need, and we also have districts that are participating in integration projects. But most we're districts that don't get the sparsity formula. We're for the most part don't get small schools revenue. So the basic formula is the formula that works best for us. And when you put money on the basic formula, that's the engine that drives all funding for us, or our greater share of funding. And we certainly look at that as being extremely important. We also talk about increase in special education funding. Many of our districts are trying to pass referenda basically to fund the cross-subsidy from special education, from general education, your general fund, to pay for special education costs. So any dollar that goes into special education stems that leakage from your general fund over to special pay for special education costs, and again, reduces reliance on referenda in the long run. On some of the other issues, we want to balance the shift buyback with the ongoing revenue needs. There's something in play. There is law in place. We've made great strides from when we went from 60-40 at the end of the 2011 session to where now we're back to 82.5. We think that the provisions in law do well enough. We don't think we need to accelerate the shift buyback. Funding for all-day kindergarten and career and technical education are important to the organization. I kind of put this together quickly. We want to fully fund mandates, and bullying is not a mandate, but bullying prevention is the mandate, so I guess. And when Mr. Aronson talked about programs over paperwork, that's something that we were very, very interested in, but to fully fund those programs that are going to prevent bullying. Eliminate the ballot language that says by voting yes on a ballot question, you're raising property taxes. We kind of think that's self-evident and that language is superfluous, and also then to increase the alternative compensation pool if we're going to continue with things like the teacher evaluation. More districts may want to go into Q comp. We want to prevent a proration of the funds for those who are already in Q comp. So if districts want to go in that direction as they work with teacher evaluation, we want to make sure that the pool is big enough there to accommodate all who are interested. Just in a final, I'd be remiss to say that we're a little bit disappointed in the governor's budget. Given the work that was done on the, especially on the property tax equity pieces on the governor's task force, where they did bring back the general education levy and significantly increased the referendum and debt service equalization factors, to not have those come into the budget is extremely disappointing for us. And also, if you look at page 20 of the governor's budget document, it kind of shows that the gap is getting worse between high and low property wealth districts, and the property tax effort needed to raise the state revenue, average revenue through the referendum is also worsening. And to see those things getting worse and then the budget not addressing that, we think that that's a shortcoming, and we certainly want to work with the governor's office, the Department of Education, the committees in the House and Senate to remedy this situation. Looking at, of course, part of this is in the tax system. We're one of the districts that are groups of districts that more often than not straddle the worlds of tax policy and education policy, and we certainly want to keep those of you who are on the tax committees kind of clued in as to what we're doing, and we're worried about the refund system because that could actually make the system worse. We want to make sure that the system does not get worse. So with that, I really thank you for your time today. I hope I haven't gone over my allotted time.
Very good. Thank you, Mr. Lundell. And again, members, we're going to actively listen and have a lot of opportunity over the next several weeks to pose questions and discussion. Next, Mary Gilbert.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. I'm Mary Gilbert. I'm the legislative liaison for the St. Paul Public Schools. And we did pass out a one-pager. Regarding the front page, gives you some fast facts about the St. Paul Public Schools. I think it's probably the most diverse school district in the country. We are certainly blessed with a wide demographic population that is pretty much equally represented between Asian American, African American, Caucasian, with a large Hispanic population, as well as Native American Indians. We have approximately 4,000 new students to the district every year, and 2,000 of them are at the secondary level, and half of them are ELL learners and primarily new immigrants. And so we have quite a challenge with the immigrant population that are coming to us most recently straight from camps with little or no education and almost no English whatsoever. 17% of our population are special education students, 73% are free and reduced lunch, and last year we had over 2,000 homeless students. Unfortunately, because of the economy, we expect to far exceed that homeless population this year. We had nearly 1,800 by Christmas this year that we're transporting under the highly mobile and homeless transportation. The district is singularly focused under our strategic plan on closing the achievement gap. I invite any of you to either visit our schools or take a look at our data center at all of the dashboards that we keep on seeing how we progress in that area. We've been making great progress in that. As far as closing the achievement gap, every time we do an intervention and improve all the cohorts within the district, we actually improve the white cohort as well. And so every intervention increases graduation rates, reading, math scores, and the like go up for the Caucasian students as well. And so closing that achievement gap is continues to be an ongoing goal of ours, but struggle that we are working vociferously for. Our legislative agenda, which is on the backside, we tried to summarize it. We were pleased that many of the recommendations, we did participate in the School Finance Task Force as well, were included in the governor's budget. I want to point out that we are wholeheartedly in support of the all-day kindergarten proposal that I know is a high priority of the Senate and for all students. On our agenda, we included the recommendation from the School Finance Task Force, but we fully support having it be available to every single school district in the state. We were very pleased about the changes and the investment in special education. That is a huge cross-subsidy for the St. Paul Public Schools as well as the ELL recommendation. We currently spend about $12 million from our general fund budget to support our English language learners. We're working with the authors, and we have been following the Integration Task Force. As you know, we started an integration, a voluntary integration program in the 1980s, which provides a rich and wonderful choice opportunity for students in St. Paul to experience language immersion, Montessori, international baccalaureate, aerospace, which not only helps provide choice in St. Paul for our families to meet the needs of their kids, but also because there's some choice when our mobile families move around all over the district, they actually get to stay in the same school and program because we have that option available. We are focused on increasing the graduation rate and college and career readiness. Senator Wieger, our chairman, has carried the compulsory attendance bill, which is quite controversial in this committee. We would like, even if we could make some progress on that and move it to 17, we think that would be a step in the right direction as another tool to keep kids in school, as well as eliminating some of the high-stakes tests that we know for a fact are moving some of our kids out of the school system because they get too discouraged about the high-stakes test, and replace them with something that would be more appropriate for students and kids. We have a couple of very small recommendations for homeless and to promote some post-secondary enrollment collaboration that we think will be non-controversial. And like all districts right now, unfortunately, in light of what happened in Connecticut, we are seriously looking at all the issues around school safety as well. My final plea would be that you do not pass any unfunded mandates. We already have plenty that we're dealing with, and so that would be my final plug to the committee, that I know there's lots and lots of really, really good ideas out here, but we are stretched, and we would really appreciate it if we had a new job to do that it would be completely funded.
Thank you, Ms. Gilbert. Margot Bault.
Good morning, Chair Wieger and members of the committee. I'm Margot Bault, president of the Minnesota Association of School Business Officials, and I represent about 600 members in the area of school business management, public accounting, and support operations to the school environment, such as food service, transportation, facilities management, and in some cases, technology. We serve many customers in our daily work, to include taxpayers, parents, and most importantly, our students. In that, our members work at balancing budgets and also balancing the needs of our students on a daily basis, looking at both short-term and long-term. So we do understand in our daily work the challenges also that you face, because we face them also at the local level. Our legislative committee promotes adoption of proposals that promote efficiency and effectiveness in the school finance area and our operations. What you'll find different from our platform from others is that it's all related to the school finance and operations area, because that is our area of expertise. And none are intended to redistribute in a significant way the resources amongst districts within the state. And also, many are designed to promote efficiency and effectiveness without asking for additional resources. Now, there are some proposals that do ask for additional resources also. Our 2013 platform, the main focus of that is the Commissioner's Working Group on School Funding. The existing funding system has been in place for decades, and our members deal with the complexities of that on a daily basis. MASBO supports the work and the report of the working group. We strongly recommend that legislators use the report as a framework to guide the discussions to enhance and improve our school funding legislation. The working group recommendations, I won't go through all of them for you, certainly have many areas that do make major structural changes in the school funding system, and we do strongly support that. And we also support the phased-in implementation. We believe that's fiscally responsible to do that. And it also addresses some issues with special education funding that others have addressed here this morning. The remainder of our proposals are focused on changes to the current funding statutes, just in case the funding task force recommendations are not implemented. So in the area of school finance, we would ask for some increases in the basic formula. Again, we are having challenges meeting our budgets, and certainly some sort of increase in the basic formula. Also, repayment of the tax shifts over time. We know financially that sometimes implementing major changes are best done incrementally over time, and we would support that. Integration revenue, just taking a look at both of the task force results and some improvements there. Mandate reform and reduction, and alternative facilities program enhancement to include all districts to qualify versus just a number of districts that qualify in the state. Our platform, the Ewald Consulting, are the MASBO lobbyists. And they will provide you our platform handouts tomorrow morning. Either Val or Nick will provide those to you. I want to thank you for your time today and also offer our time to you as you're proceeding throughout the legislative session. Our members are willing and able to answer questions that you might have in the area of the school finance and funding and operations area. We're more than willing to be a part of this conversation and would like to partner with you. And so, at any time, please feel free to contact us. We are more than happy to help.
Thank you very much, Ms. Bach. Amy Walstein.
Hi, Amy Walstein. I'm the Director of Education and Workforce Development Policy at the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce. And I provided to the committee administrator a background sheet that is in your packets. But what I wanted to do is just kind of give some background on why education is important to the business community and how that relates to this committee. The Minnesota Chamber of Commerce is focused on improving the education to workforce pipeline to ensure that all students are receiving a world-class education and are well prepared for the workforce. We're at a critical point right now in Minnesota. Jobs are requiring an increasing level of education. We've heard that by 2018, 70% of the jobs are going to require some post-secondary education. And in the K-12 pipeline, there are fewer students, and more students are on the other side of our wide achievement gap. So what we need to do is increase in the short term the number of students who are completing their education, and we need to strengthen that pipeline so that all students are moving through with a strong education. To that end, we think there are several key improvements to strengthen the education pipeline. Some of our recommendations this year focus a little bit more on post-secondary than in the past, and where that touches on K-12 education is we think that there are some key improvements on a better aligning K-12 and post-secondary. Alignment of K-12 academic standards and assessments with post-secondary measures. The recommendations that came out of the task force that was looking at assessments, we think there's some really good stuff there, and we want to continue that conversation. We also want to make sure that it's meaningful in terms of what a high school diploma means for graduation. Expansion of post-secondary, early college, dual enrollment options for students so that they are able to gain post-secondary credits while they're in the K-12 system. and better integration of career and workforce readiness into the K-12 system. That's mentorships, apprenticeships, internships, things like that. We've got some other recommendations regarding post-secondary that probably more in the purview of the Higher Ed Committee. But they focus on making education more affordable, more efficient, building collaboration, more partnerships between the business community and education. On the K-12 side, we're looking at continuing recommendations that ensure we have effective teachers in every classroom and effective administrators in every building. We believe that teachers should be evaluated based on student outcomes and that evaluation should be used for retention decisions. We think that enhanced professional development for teachers and administrators is critical. Alternative paths to teacher licensure is one way that we get at increasing the number of effective teachers in the classroom. And to that end, you know, continuing the work that's been done on that to make sure that it is a strong system. Academic standards and accountability is another area where we must make sure that we're training students to be best in the world. High school graduates need to demonstrate that they are meeting state graduation standards and college readiness expectations. Our accountability system is part of this, and we need to make sure that our accountability system is focused on measuring student proficiency as well as student growth. Other areas where that we've included in our information are on centered around high-quality charter schools, increasing the number of high-quality charter schools, as well as making sure that the ones that aren't performing as well are being held accountable for that. Third grade literacy has been a focus that we've had in the past as well, and continuing to make sure that we've got strong measures in place for that critical point in third grade where reading is important. Early childhood is another area where the chamber has an interest in making sure that there's strong early childhood education programs that are aimed at closing that kindergarten preparation gap so that low-income students and high-income students are at the same place as they're entering kindergarten. And that includes parent aware rating system strengthening and improving access to early childhood programs through scholarships. When we were here last, I spoke a little bit on the education task force recommendations, the education funding task force recommendations, and then I did provide that letter to you via email. If anyone has any questions on that, we're happy to answer those as well. But one point that I want to make on that is that we believe that investments in the education system need to be tied to measurable outcomes. And I think there's areas within the K-12 budget where programs that are not showing that they're closing the achievement gap, let's look at those and maybe reinvest those in areas where there is measurable achievement gap accountability. And I also wanted to touch very briefly on data. Data quality is of critical importance, and as we are looking at education through an outcome-based system, making sure that we have the right data and that that data is accessible to parents, teachers, administrators, as well as research and post-secondary. That will help improve policy decision-making. With that, I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Ms. Wallstein. I think we're not going to be taking questions this morning, but thanks for your testimony. And we'll move on to Jan Alschweiger from the Education Minnesota.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I am Jan Alschweiger, Chief Lobbyist for Education Minnesota, former teacher. Our four main goals or priorities this year are education funding, closing the achievement gap, investing in professional educators and employment standards. I will only be addressing a few of the items. Thank you. Few of the items in our top four, just because in the top three, education funding, closing the achievement gap, and investing in professional educators, because those are under the purview of this committee. Education Minnesota strongly believes that we need to provide sufficient and adequate and equitable funding for our schools. You are going to be receiving a document that you are receiving a document that I will talk about in a moment, because I'd like to talk about it after it's in your hands. So I'll come back to funding. But we do have situations all over the state where kids are in classrooms of 42 kids with one teacher. And when our teachers are working extremely hard to meet the needs of all of these kids, their individual academic needs, their emotional and social needs, it becomes quite difficult to do the very best when you have 42 or 38 kids in your classroom. So the funding would certainly help with that situation. Education Minnesota is also supporting all-day, every-day kindergarten because we feel that this will help close the achievement gap and provide kids with the instruction and the resources that they need to make improvements in their education. In our overall priority of closing the achievement gap, I will first say that we are ready and willing and eager to work with any legislator who has a good idea to close the achievement gap. Some of the ideas and things that we have been talking about and will be promoting our class size, as I just mentioned. Also expanding funding for early childhood in the public school system, requiring school districts to develop and implement plans to enhance parent and community involvement, because without the parents, it's difficult to have a partnership to help kids be successful. And also, we believe that our educators do need additional training and planning time to support and address the issues of racial and socioeconomic inequity through research-based practices. We don't want to just pick something out of the sky and do it. We want programs that are proven. And in 2011, the teacher evaluation law was passed, and Education Minnesota is embracing that law, and we want to make sure that it works. However, there was no funding associated with the teacher evaluation law. So Education Minnesota will be working to pursue additional funding for that. What does it need? The Minnesota Management and Budget stated at one point that it would cost, I believe it was $80 million to fund this program. And who knows if that is the right number? But what we do know is that our administrators and teachers are not trained in this evaluation system. And we need to train administrators in terms of using the standards of effective practice. The staff development money comes back, the 2%, this is a whole other discussion, but the 2% staff development comes back July 1st of this year. But there is no money now because of the law last year that took away the staff development distribution to the sites, the requirement to do that. There is no guarantee that our sites are going to have staff development money, and that's very key in having a successful teacher evaluation program, which we can talk about more later. So then let's go to the funding document that I handed out. I do have a document for every one of your school districts, and I will show you in a future hearing how every one of your school districts rank in terms of their level of funding with state aid, revenue, and levy. So let me explain the document before you. This is all based on Minnesota Department of Education data. The revenue amounts include general education, special education, career, technical integration, alternative facilities, deferred maintenance, telecom, communications. I won't read them all, but they're there in the notes section for you. It is based on the adjusted average daily membership. And I just a note that in 2010, it includes the $500 million, in one-time federal aid. And it is converted based from 2003 to 2013 using the implicit price deflator. That is the figure that is used for state government, and it projects what those costs would be. So let's take a look on average for the state. In constant 2013 dollars, total state aid to Minnesota District declined by $1,563 over the last decade. School property tax levy increases of $752 per pupil provided less than half what was needed to replace the state aid reduction. Consequently, school district total operating revenue decreased by $811 per pupil. So you look at the graph. The state aid adjusted for inflation with the implicit price deflator is the red line at the bottom. The green line at the top is the levy referendum that they levy that they have received or that they have passed. You will notice when you get the other documents later that these will be all over the map because some districts are able to pass levy referendums in differing amounts and some are not able to pass levy referendums at all. The bottom line is, not really the bottom line, it's the second from the bottom line, is the blue line that gives you the total revenue that a district actually receives statewide. But you know, averages are kind of deceiving because, you know, I could be in freezing weather or I could be in boiling hot weather. On average, I'm doing just fine. I don't need a coat. I don't need an air conditioner. But when you see the individual districts, you will be surprised. So I would just like to end with Education Minnesota is supporting additional funding so that all kids have access to a sufficiently funded and equitable education. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Allswiger. We'll be looking forward to those individual charts. Mr. Walseth and Ms. Hasbargen.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. My name is Sam Walseth. I'm the lobbyist for the Minnesota Rural Education Association. Just a little background about MREA. It's a coalition of about 155 school districts, big and small, across greater Minnesota. We have a very unique governing board, which is comprised of school board members, school administrators, and educators across the great state of Minnesota. We're here today to let you know that we're available to assist you as you discuss. Oh, excuse me. I have my addition to the paper blizzard, Madam Chair. Make sure the page can get that out to the members. We're here today to we thank you for the opportunity to introduce ourselves to the committee, let you know that we're available for questions, to talk about how various policy and finance proposals will impact schools in greater Minnesota. But we want to make a couple of points today, Madam Chair and members, and that is, first and foremost, we're pleased to see a state government budget plan that includes new state revenue. We believe that can go a long way toward providing equity and adequacy in the public education system. The governor's revenue plan has the potential to complete what we believe is a state promise made to Minnesota school children 12 years ago, the first session I joined the legislature in this endeavor. And that promise was to pay for general education. And there was a big promise at the time and a big buy down of property taxes. We don't think you've lived up to that challenge from 12 years ago, but we think the governor's revenue plan has gives you the opportunity to fulfill that mission. We support the governor's goals of creating structural balance through the budget tails, stabilizing state revenues, rebuilding a progressive tax system, and meeting benchmarks for children, including getting all children ready to learn, ready to graduate, and onto a college and career program. We support his down payments on all-day kindergarten, reducing the special ed cross subsidy, money on the basic formula, initiating formula reform. You're going to hear a lot of talk. You've already had some conversations about that. We believe the regional centers of excellence that he's proposed funding for is a good way to help small school districts in greater Minnesota initiate and implement best practices to help close the achievement gap. And non-QCOMP evaluation aid to assist those small schools in paying for evaluations for staff that they don't currently have. However, Madam Chair and members, we do believe more work is needed this session. We believe you need to take a close look at the Education Finance Reform Report recommendations. I've been involved in endeavors over the last decade to come up with formula reforms, and we've had Governor Plenty's task force, we've had PS Minnesota, the price tags go to the moon. We think the report that you reviewed the other week is probably the best, most rational, cost-effective approach to begin implementing formula reform, and we really encourage you to embrace that, specifically the general education levy. We think in 2001, when the state eliminated the general education levy, we walked away from half a century of equity and stability in the system. And we got a little too smart for our own good. And we think you need to revisit the general education levy and look at that mechanism that's recommended in that task force report. The facilities funding, reform for facilities, financing in the task force report, we think you need to take a look at that too. A lot of greater Minnesota districts do not qualify for alternative facilities bond authority. We don't have a lot of debt service equalization left out there. We think the state can do a lot to help school districts in that regard. And school-based early childhood programs. Madam Chair, members, as you debate the E-12 budget this session, we want you to keep a few things in mind. I've already mentioned the ed finance reform recommendations as a good blueprint for starting your work. We'd like you to keep in mind the inequity in general education funding. That's grown between the wealthiest and poorest districts to over 30% disparity in general education funding. These are levels not seen since the 1990s. I think a decade ago they were down to about 18.6% in terms of that gap, and now we're over 31%. And that is a big concern. And the referendum process drives a lot of that disparity. But as Ms. Alschwager just testified, you've got a lot of districts out there that really struggle to pass those referenda. Specifically for a lot of the districts we represent, local operating referenda are problematic. We may have wealthy districts in rural Minnesota when you look at the agricultural land out there, but we can't tax it. Referendum market value, what school districts pass their operating levies on, is not on adjusted net tax capacity. And that was a change from 2001 as well. And districts only tax or referendum market value, which does not include ag production land and does not include the cabin tax. Now, we're not saying put all of that, especially the ag production land, you don't necessarily have to put all that back on the referendum market value, but understand that referendum market value for a lot of school districts is a fraction, a small fraction of what their total adjusted net tax capacity is. And we do think specifically you need to look at taking the seasonal recreational property out of the statewide levy and putting that back into referendum market value. There are a lot of districts in central Minnesota with a lot of wealthy cabin tax that is being paid. We're not asking the cabins to pay more. We're just saying, state, you need to transfer that wealth back to the local districts to assist those districts in their referendum and efforts. And last point I want to make, Madam Chair and members, we believe, you know, we share a lot of values, I think, with Schools for Equity. Equalization across the board is a much better approach than doing direct property tax rebates. We'd encourage you to look at enhancing and improving the equalization factors. They've been frozen in place since, I think, about 1994, 1995 levels. Property valuations, obviously, in the last 20 years have eroded the purchasing power of the current equalization factor. So with that, Madam Chair and members, we've got lots to talk about this year, and that's just a snapshot of where we'd like you to begin.
That's quite a snapshot.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Very nice. Thank you.
Madam Chair, I have a guest with me who is going to be working with MREA again this session. It's my honor to introduce you the person who mentored me in understanding rural school issues. That's Renee Hasbargen. She's got a few comments if there's time.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Members, I'm Renee Hasbargen. I am a former director of the Minnesota Rural Education Association, but I've been retired for a few years. And frankly, it was the promise of the task force's work that led me back here to urge you to look closely at their recommendations universally, but especially their recommendations to establish a general education levy and to re-equalize our levies out there that have grown increasingly unfair for schools. I know I speak for Dr. Fred Nolan, the current director, and all our members when I say that we were really hopeful that the governor, because of the recommendations of his task force, would include those recommendations in his budget. They have the support of every member of the task force, almost. They have the consensus and the support of all the school organizations, and that doesn't happen much around here. So you have a solid blueprint, as Mr. Walseth indicated, to work from, and we would urge your strong consideration. Sam has pointed out what is to like about the governor's budget. There's a lot to like. But I must say that we are disappointed about two things. First of all, we're disappointed that the governor chose to reform the sales tax before he chose to reform the property tax. We were really hopeful that the property tax would be first on his agenda, especially after the task force's work. But more importantly, we are disappointed at the one-time rebates as a way to do property tax relief instead of dealing with the structural reform that's really necessary long-term. You heard last week Mary Ciccone, who was a member of that task force, say it was the tax fairness of that report that was the most compelling feature and the reason that the consensus has been formed around it. It's a solid blueprint, a solid recommendation, and please keep that in front of you. Sam and Jan before Sam have already indicated the increasing gap between the highest funded and the lowest funded students of the state.
Ms. Hasbargen, it is you're over your time, and I've been told that. So you have okay. You can finish up. Certainly,
I just have one more thing to say.
Certainly,
that gap is as big now as it was in 1990 when a group of parents and school districts sued the state of Minnesota, and out of that came the requirement that the legislature equalize referendums. So, Madam Chair, we urge you to do that this year, to look at the general education tax, and to support the report.
Thank you for your testimony. And just a reminder, you know, the governor's proposal is just the first step. So thanks for your input.
Thank you.
Mr. Amoroso.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Gary Amoroso. I have the honor of serving as the executive director of the Minnesota Association of School Administrators, commonly known as the Superintendents Association. But it is important to note that in addition to probably having 99.9% of the superintendents as members of our association, we also have members who are directors of curriculum instruction, directors of special education, assistant superintendents, university professors. So we have a wide gamut of individuals that are members of our association. I'd like to just share a few thoughts with you. The document that you're going to be receiving is our platform. We had about 75 of our members get together on two different occasions to have conversations about what we viewed as what was important for us as we move forward in continuing to move Minnesota towards providing a world-class education for all of its children. The context of our conversations were that we know that we have fiscal challenges as a state. We want to be realistic, understanding that the state is facing a deficit for this next biennium. But yet, if we felt it would be important for us to share with you what we felt were our priorities. And when you look at our document on the left side, that's the education funding piece, the items under number one really are a prioritization. We fully understand that there would be no way that all of these items could be accomplished. There wouldn't be enough dollars in order to make that happen. So as you look at our platform, I'd like to just share a few thoughts on those items. And again, note that these were priorities as we saw them. Adequate, equitable, sustainable funding. That is our focus. We want to be good stewards of the dollars that the states provide. We want our communities to have faith in their school system and know that their school administrators and their school boards are working on behalf of children and are doing it in an effective and efficient manner. In order to do that, in order to be a good faith planner with a budget, you need to have predictability. You have to have a sense of what will be the dollars available moving forward. And a two-year window, quite frankly, is not enough of a window for people to be good faith planners. It causes concern to our communities. And one of the things that we were thinking was that would there be a way to link the general ed formula, the basic formula, to the rate of inflation? So that on a biennium basis, it doesn't have to be a point of discussion. Will there be money put on the formula? Will there not be money be put on the formula? As a school administrator, I can tell you the superintendents in the state, along with the school boards, are already beginning to plan out their 2013-14 budget and 14-15. And today they're sitting there. They see the governor's recommendation, and we appreciate the fact that there are new funds for public education for next year and the following year. But there's not a certainty of what those funds will be, or even a sense of what they may look like. And because of that, tough decisions have to be made that have an impact on the professionals and the support staff that we work with, and in the end can have an impact on the education that the children receive. So one of our thoughts is to tie the basic formula to the inflationary rate. That rate can be established by the state of Minnesota. It would at least give us a sense of what things might look like and what they could look like moving forward. At least we have a ballpark idea. Secondly, we're very pleased to see that the governor is beginning to address the issue of the cross-subsidy in special education. His budget of a proposal of $180 reduction in the cross-subsidy will provide real dollars that school districts can take from supporting special education students to supporting the remainder of the students in the district. That is something that we feel very strongly about, and certainly hope that You as a Senate Finance Committee and the House Finance Committee will take a hard look at continuing to reduce that cross-subsidy, which puts real dollars in the hands of our schools to use on behalf of children. Our third area, and you've heard a lot about this already, so I won't belabor it, but we have the principal evaluation being implemented next year. We have the teacher evaluation process being implemented in July of 14. We have the bullying prevention statute that will, we believe, be written in this session and be passed. Those are very, very worthy programs. We fully support accountability for our principals and our teachers. We fully support the concept that we must have the safest schools in the country for our children and for our staff. But there are going to be need to be resources made available to assist us. Without resources to assist us in implementing those programs, resources will have to be taken from existing programs, which once again cause us to make very challenging decisions, which generally in the end will restrict opportunities for children. So we appreciate the fact that the governor's budget begins to address this, but we also hope that you will continue that conversation as you move forward in your session. Integration and equity funding, our thought there is to make sure that we provide those dollars to the children across the entire state who have the greatest need for those dollars. So we hope that as you're moving forward with the integration and equity conversation, you keep in mind that this is a statewide issue for children in poverty. All-day kindergarten, access to early childhood. Once again, the governor begins to address this. We are grateful that the conversation is about voluntary programming. While we all, I believe, embrace the concept of all-day K, I know that there are districts within our state that if this were a mandatory program, we would have space issues, and we wouldn't be able to implement. So we appreciate the fact, and we hope that you continue to consider the fact that the kindergarten program on an all-day basis be voluntary and continue to look at moving that funding up towards 1.0. And then the current pension subtraction, this has been in place, I believe, since 1997. It's about $32 per pupil unit. Again, this would be something that would assist our schools in being able to provide for the children in the system. I know I'm running close to my time, so I'll stop with that, other than to say that this was our first blush of a platform. We stand ready as an association to work with you, to work with your colleagues in the House, to work with the governor's office, to work with the Department of Education, to move forward in a collaborative fashion to create a funding system that, again, goes back to being adequate, equitable, and sustainable for the children of the state. And I thank you and look forward to working with you this session.
Great. Thank you, Mr. Amoroso. Mr. Harris.
Yes, Mr. Chair. Good morning, members. And I'd like the musical chairs, literally, that's happening here. It's going to clearly keep us on our toes.
It works.
This session is working right now for you, Mr. Chair. All right. Good morning, members. Shep Harris. I'm with the law firm of Fredrickson and Byron. And I just wanted to briefly go through a couple of clients that we're representing this session. And as the staffer's handing out one item, I just wanted to mention a couple of clients in passing that aren't on my list. First is the Minnesota Optometric Association. It's the optometrists here in Minnesota, and normally that's in the Health and Human Services Committee, but as you may be hearing from Senator Johnson in the future, I've already been talking with her a little bit about vision screening issues in the schools. In fact, we did a little work last year on some notification issues, so feel free to use the Optometric Association as a resource if you have any questions about screening issues in school. The second group is known as the Minnesota Autism Center. It's the largest organization in the state that provides therapy services, and they have a private school based in Eagan, and they're looking at the possibility of opening one in Minnetonka as well. And so their interest will be specifically with non-public pupil aid if those issues come up. And third of the four groups I just wanted to mention, this one is a much larger organization. It's actually a state agency, which you'll hopefully be hearing more about in the near future, is the Purpich Center for Arts Education. I am here on their behalf through their foundation, and hopefully you'll hear more about them in the future. But the information that you're being handed out right now is with the group that you rarely hear about, and frankly what's this organization, what they like to do is they like to really keep their distance from the legislature and really not bother you unless they really have to. So in your mind, you might think that's a great organization. It's the Minnesota Association of Independent Schools. And as you can see on this list, They have a few agenda items. Primarily, they want to be a resource to you. If you have questions about independent schools, non-public schools, they're here to answer some of those questions. They would like to preserve their independent status as independent organizations. And so you've already heard the buzzword unfunded mandate. You'll hear that word, that phrase over and over again. And that's something that not only public schools share, but also private schools share too. So maintaining their independent status. In fact, for example, in the past, you might be surprised by this, but this organization actually had concerns with voucher proposals in the past because they understood that if the voucher proposals were to come forward, there potentially could be strings attached to that. There could be state mandates, and that's where they want to maintain their independent status. So we're always monitoring that. And then finally, minimizing any sort of reductions to non-public pupil aid. That, again, is another issue that they're here for. And just to give you a couple fast facts, you see the list of the schools. They're primarily metro-based. There are a couple in greater Minnesota. And on the back, I just wanted to really what this all does is stress a point about a partnership. This is a partnership with the overall education system here in Minnesota. It's a partnership with you. They do want to let you know that there's some perceptions out there about private schools, but in fact, the way they see it is that they help work with the state. They actually save the state money in terms of public dollars. They also provide a number of vital jobs, as you can see in some of these bullet points, in terms of what they're saving taxpayers, the number of jobs, the health and retirement benefits to Minnesotans, as well as the scholarships that they provide to students. And so the final point I just want to make is that as I leave, the final point I want to leave with you really is to see this organization and independent schools not as an opponent of public schools, but as part of the larger ongoing effort to help challenge and educate our children here in Minnesota. So I look forward to working with you on these issues in the future. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Great.
Thank you, Mr. Harris. Mr. Kroonquist.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members. My name is Scott Kroonquist with the Association of Metropolitan School Districts, and I do have a handout if the page could help with distributing that. Mr. Chairman and members, AMSD is an organization that's been in existence since 1974. We represent 37 school districts in the metropolitan area, in addition to the three intermediate school districts in the metro area and the three integration school districts. Just about one half of the students in the state of Minnesota are enrolled in one of our member school districts. I'm going to just briefly touch on some of the items in our legislative platform, which is being distributed now. You'll see on the cover we have the citation of the Minnesota Constitution. Mr. Nauman shared that with you when he did his overview, and we agree that that's a good place to start and a good reminder that the state has a constitutional obligation related to K-12 education. And we think most of the people of Minnesota would agree that the state is not meeting that constitutional obligation currently. So we want to work with you to make progress towards doing that. A couple of items I just want to touch on. Several organizations have already said this, but we really urge you to make new investments in education a priority while paying back the shift over time. We think the current law is working well. The shift has been largely repaid, in fact, over the last year, and we think that current law will get that job done over time, and so we don't think you need to accelerate repayment of the shift. Another item that we have worked on for a number of years is a proposal to allow school boards, your elected school boards, to renew an existing referendum, so not a new referendum, an existing referendum, by a majority vote of the school board. We think in the state right now we have a really uneven fiscal system, a system where our elected city councils, if they see a need in their community, if their taxpayers come to them and want them to provide a new service, they have the ability then to adjust their levy and provide that service. Same thing with our township boards, our county boards. At the school level, if that situation arises, the school board has to say, well, I guess we'll have to put it to a vote. And we definitely think that is not very consistent with the constitutional obligation. And we're actually just proposing a very modest step. Again, as I mentioned, this would just allow a board to renew an existing referendum. Another item you'll see is we think that, for one, would help reduce the reliance on the referendum in adjusting the cost differentials that exist. You've heard a lot in the presentations from the department and even today about the variance between the 95th and the 5th, and that certainly is important information to look at. but you really need to dive into that a little deeper in order to determine which state policies you should pursue to address that. And in fact, there's been a couple studies done in recent years, one by the Hamline School of Business, and another one, which was actually done at the direction of the Senate. It was a Senate initiative directed the Midwest Regional Education Laboratory to examine differences in spending across school districts by geographic region. And if you look at either of those reports, you'll see that they both come to a similar conclusion, and that conclusion is that once you consider student needs, once you consider things like student poverty, English language, and once you look at cost differentials in terms of what does it cost to provide services by locale, that disparity largely vanishes. Not that it's totally gone, and there certainly are areas that need to be addressed, but it largely vanishes. So I would encourage you to look at those reports. Next item, full-day kindergarten. We really appreciate the Senate making that a top priority. We think the evidence is clear. That is an important step to addressing the achievement gap. A number of our districts have implemented it. Some have done it district-wide. Others are trying to get there. Obviously, they're not getting funding for that now, so they're having to divert other general education funding to do that. The research in our district shows that gaps are closed and student achievement is enhanced when we have full-day kindergarten. So we appreciate the Senate's emphasis on that. Special education, I'm not going to say much about it, but the simple reality is it's the 800-pound gorilla in education finance. It is the reason that almost every school district in the state struggles from year to year with their budgets, the fact that we're not funding special education. Integration revenue, top priority for AMSD and for our members. As you all know, under current law, the integration revenue program sunsets. We think it's very important that the legislature and governor act this year to continue that program, albeit possibly in a reformed format. We think the Integration Revenue Replacement Task Force offers you some great guidelines and a blueprint for moving forward on that front. And then finally, the last item I want to touch on, we were happy to see the governor propose some funding to help school districts implement the teacher evaluation process. Clearly a need, and now that every school district's going to have to do that, that's important that that funding follow. However, we would say there's been some talk about QCOMP and whether or not that QCOMP dollars should be diverted, and we would caution you not to do that. The school districts that have implemented QCOMP have found it to be highly successful. It's been embraced by both the administration and the staff in virtually all of those districts that have it. And keep in mind that QCOMP districts, that those dollars are not simply going to fund teacher evaluation. QCOMP districts have to do a lot more than teacher evaluation. So we think it's an effective program that's working and is also helping close gaps and really enhancing professional development among our teachers. So we have a lot more, but I'm going to stop there. Mr. Chairman and members, we'd be happy to work with you throughout the session. And again, our top goal is to help you have the state live up to that constitutional obligation. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Kroonquist. Moving on, Ms. Armstrong.
Hi, my name is Tina Armstrong. I'm with the Minnesota Council for Gifted and Talented. We are a statewide nonprofit organization of parents, educators, and other professionals who live and work with gifted kids and are interested in their education and well-being. We've been around for 55 years. And our mission is to promote better understanding of and educational services for gifted and talented kids. We've got over 600 members in our statewide organization and reach thousands more through 27 local chapters and parent groups. In the handout that's coming around, you will see that we have parent groups in many of your communities and throughout the state, including very active outstate chapters in New Prague, New Ulm, Owatonna, Duluth and Rochester. We also have parent groups organized around special topics in gifted ed, including the highly gifted. Our largest group is our homeschoolers. There are a lot of parents homeschooling gifted and talented kids. And Twice Exceptional is another one of our large parent groups that deals with the gifted and talented kids that are both GT and special ed, that they do have learning disabilities that also need to be addressed.
You know, I am here today. Obviously, you have heard through the governor's budget and through the recommendations of the Education Finance Work Group. I've got to talk about finance this year, because gifted and talented revenue is one component of the general education revenue. And what you will see on the back side is our two statutes around gifted ed. We have both a services statute that is not a mandate. There is no mandate on identification of gifted kids. There is no mandate on services for gifted and talented or on teacher training in this state. So what we rely on is really what government does well, which is incentivize through funding these types of programs. Some of our greatest successes for gifted and talented kids has been the growth of full-time gifted programs. We're up to 14 full-time gifted programs in the state. It started, we started having these before we had our funding. So, kudos to St. Paul and Capitol Hill Magnet School. That's been around since 1978. But when we first got gifted funding, we saw the growth in Invergrove Heights, of Athenaeum, in Spring Lake Park, of the Lighthouse Program, in Bloomington, of Dimensions Academy and Elements. And more recently, there has been a big growth in full-time gifted programs within the metro area. We're seeing Harriet Bishop in Burnsville, Egan Savage, Sage Academy in Prior Lake Savage, the Navigator Program in Minnetonka, Pinewood Elementary in Rosemont, Apple Valley in Egan, and Ignite in Lakeville. These have all grown in these last few years as we've had our gifted and talented funding. And our concern is, if this gifted and talented funding, which there's $11.5 million around the state, $500,000 going to that school district that had our first gifted and talented program, to St. Paul Public Schools, that the incentive, absent a mandate, to continue to fund gifted ed will go away. There are so many mandates. There is so much reality to running a school district that without funding that is dedicated to this, to our state's gifted and talented students, we definitely have concerns. I had one of the superintendents, school district members from an outstate district wrote to me that money is the kind of thing that a government can do effectively. Encourage someone by giving them a small stipend to use for the specific purpose that has the potential to improve the well-being of the community as a whole. These kids have the potential to have a tremendous impact on our future. Positive if we acknowledge and encourage them. Tragic if we pretend that they will be all right without our guidance, leaving them ignorant of the wonders of knowledge and inquiry, desperately seeking other ways to trip their trigger. Not too worried about that school district, but I am worried about other ones. I am very concerned that if we don't have a gifted mandate, that funding will not continue to flow. Those programs that we can be proud of and will not continue to flourish. I don't want to be compared to the 10 states that do not have. There's only 10 states that do not have dedicated gifted and talented funding. There is only 4 additional states that have less than $1 million, and usually those are state positions, part-time or full-time positions in the State Department. If we lose our gifted and talented funding, I am very concerned for the gifted and talented kids and for the state because of the potential that gets lost. So my job is head mama bear for these gifted and talented kids, and I take that very seriously. And I encourage you to use that financial incentive to continue to encourage these programs. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Armstrong. Real quickly, before we move to our next speaker, I just want to say that if there are people here who would like to make a presentation, and if we do have additional time, please let us know, and we will try to add you to the schedule. Thank you. And our next presenter is Jim Bartholomew from the Minnesota Business Partnership. Mr. Bartholomew.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair, members. Who'd have thought you'd get through 18 groups and still have time? Thanks. My name is Jim Bartholomew. I'm the Education Policy Director with the Minnesota Business Partnership. And just briefly, members of the Business Partnership are the chief executives of Minnesota's largest employers, employing over 400,000 Minnesotans and 2 million people worldwide. They're companies like 3M, General Mills, Medtronic, and the Mayo Clinic. Education remains a top priority for our members because it is so foundational to Minnesota's ability to succeed in the global economy. And they also see on a daily basis the efforts of other countries to improve their competitiveness through education. While Minnesota has earned a strong reputation for the quality of our educational system, two recently released reports highlight both our opportunities and our challenges. The first report in late November showed the results of the most recent international assessment of student performance in math and science, the TIMSS test. Nearly 60 countries and selected U.S. states participated in this exam. Through the great work of our educators and students, Minnesota's eighth graders performed amongst the best in the world, improving on our results from 2007. This is a great example of the opportunities we have in Minnesota. That said, our TIMSS results also indicated that our low-income and non-white students are lagging. The second report in early December came from the U.S. Department of Education and showed that Minnesota has some of the worst four-year high school graduation rates for students of color in the U.S. In addition, our graduation rate for white students is only average. With these results, our future success is in jeopardy. Again, the TIMSS results show what's possible. The high school graduation results show us how urgently we need to better serve all students. Our first recommendation begins with creating a stronger alignment between our K-12 and post-secondary education systems. This is especially important since 70% of all jobs in Minnesota will require completion of at least some post-secondary education within the next 5 years. And I'll just quickly run through some of the points in the handout. On the second page, our first recommendation is that after ensuring alignment with our state standards, we replace the existing grad exams with the ACT exam. In addition, earning a high school diploma should be dependent on meeting admission benchmarks for a certificate-level program at a Minsky institution. Some of the benefits of this change include creating a common assessment of student preparation that's used by both K-12 and higher ed. Second, we'd give students more concrete information about their level of preparation. And third, providing academic support to students before they graduate from high school. And just as a little illustration of why we need stronger alignment so we can help students make that successful transition from K-12 to higher ed, is the chart at the bottom of that second page. The blue lines show the graduation rates, five-year graduation rates at selected school districts, high schools, around the state. The red line is the percent of students from each of those schools that needed remediation when they enrolled in a Minnesota public post-secondary institution. By creating that stronger alignment, we think we can reduce that red line, ideally to zero, but we can certainly make better progress than today. Our second recommendation, and I won't go into it much, you've heard others, but we support the expansion of the Parent Aware and Early Education Scholarship programs. Ensuring low-income families have access to quality early education services is key to helping all kids succeed. Third, and I think we're shoulder to shoulder with Education Minnesota on this, is we'd recommend continued support for implementation of the 2011 teacher evaluation law and the Department of Education's model. In general, the department's model is consistent with the basic criteria suggested by the new teacher project and findings from the Gates Foundation's Measures of Effective Teaching project. In short, these criteria include having student achievement data from the students taught by the teacher, classroom observations, and student surveys. Each of those elements is in the current model, and we think that's a great starting point. Fourth recommendation is to allow school boards and administrators to use teacher performance in making staffing decisions. Two examples of where performance should be a key factor include the unrequested leave of absence process and teacher placements. Moving to the back page quickly, our fifth recommendation is expanding opportunities to ensure all families have access to schools that can best meet their children's academic needs. And one example of this is replicating successful charter schools. Over the last few years, we've seen some charter schools, especially in the metro, that have excelled at closing student achievement gaps and raising overall performance. We think these models show great promise and can help more kids. Finally, as you consider changes to school funding, we'd suggest that you look at ways to link funding to student success. We would encourage you not to reinstate the general education levy. There were many good policy reasons for repealing that in 2001. We can talk about those later. And then finally, and this may be an issue that comes up more directly in higher ed, but based on the governor's budget, but there will be a request for continued funding for the state's longitudinal education data system, or SLEDS, and we think that's very important to maintain as well. So thank you very much. We look forward to working with everyone to make sure our kids have the best education possible. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Bartholomew. We have a slight agenda change, and so our next speaker will be Daniel Sellers from MnCamp.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. We had handed out a document earlier, so it might be in your packets. My name is Daniel Sellers, and as a former teacher, I'm honored to serve as executive director with MnCamp. Given that there seems to be some misinformation about who or what MnCamp is, and also that there is a lot of credible information about the unconscionable education opportunity gaps that exist between low-income minority students and their wealthier white peers, I'd like to briefly explain a bit about who we are and who is behind our work, as well as share our proposals for closing that gap. Notice, as requested, that it is in bullet form. MnCamp is a nonprofit. Yeah, Senator Wieger, we heard your message loud and clear. MnCamp is a nonprofit centrist education research and advocacy group. We have a three-person team that is made up entirely of Minnesotans. We have an invested, active, and committed local board of advisors with members who hail from both the Twin Cities metro area and Greater Minnesota. Members on that board who identify with the DFL, the GOP, and some who fall in between. Our work is supported by local philanthropic leaders, including Minnesota foundations, corporations, and generous individuals. 80% of our resources are raised locally. Our policy priorities are developed locally. There's no national agenda driving our work. Since we believe great schools are the key to ensuring great outcomes for all Minnesota kids, we ask ourselves, what does Minnesota need to do to create more great schools? And then we go out across the state to figure this out. We fan out to meet with community stakeholders, including leaders in the business community, representatives from teachers' unions, and leaders in minority communities. We connect with our more than 5,000 members to get their opinion, a group that includes educators and thousands of parents. We talk with those who are closest to the classroom, teachers, principals, superintendents, and school board members. In partnership with credible research firms, we conduct thorough polls to better understand the perspectives of Minnesotans, and we share the results of those polls publicly. And our platform is reviewed by our local advisory board. Over the last 2 years, 6 of the 7 priorities that MnCamp has worked on have been adopted as law, which indicates to me an ability to successfully negotiate diverse views to reach agreed-upon policy changes that are ultimately best for Minnesota students. This year, our proposals fall into 3 buckets. First, MnCamp is a member of MiniMinds, the coalition of more than 50 organizations working together to secure a $185 million investment for early childhood scholarships to be used with high-quality pre-K programs onto the Parent Aware system. We're heartened by the governor's budget, which includes $44 million for these scholarships, but a full investment of $185 million over the biennium would ensure that all 3- and 4-year-olds at or below 185% of the poverty line would have access to high-quality pre-K options. Research shows that every dollar we invest in this way produces a $16 return to the state over the life of that child. Second, we seek to reclaim the promise of public charter schools. We need to hold charter schools more accountable, especially when it comes to student achievement. We can and must create incentives to close down persistently low-performing charter schools. On the other hand, as Jim mentioned, charter schools get hurt the most under the school funding shift, especially new charter schools. So we applaud efforts to pay back the shift and are advocating for immediate relief from the shift for public charter schools in their first 5 years. We also know there are some charter schools that are doing an amazing job at closing the achievement gap and putting the students on a new and putting their students on a new life path. We consistently hear from school leaders at these schools that if they could change just one thing to help their schools, it would be to have more flexibility to hire teacher candidates who are willing to do whatever it takes to meet the needs of their students and their school's mission of closing the achievement gap. Teachers who have a track record of achievement in other states, for example, but are finding the licensing process in Minnesota tenuous, expensive, and frustratingly time-consuming. Third, we believe in a day where we have a great teacher in every Minnesota classroom. We're advocating for raising the quality of teacher preparation programs. We support the governor's proposed investment in a robust teacher evaluation system and believe that system must be tied to high-quality professional development opportunities and hold teachers accountable for improving their practice to improve student achievement. And we would like to see districts and school leaders have the flexibility to retain highly effective teachers even when layoffs are required. Of course, we think principal evaluations are critical to the school's success as well. Let's not forget about that. Finally, we hope to be a partner for all of you. We hope our data and research, policy proposals, statewide polls, and issue briefs can serve as a resource for you. We encourage you to take a moment to check out our brand new, very interactive and easy to read 2013 State of Minnesota Public Education Report, which is linked on our website mincan.org. And we look forward to working with you to improve student achievement over the next 4 years and beyond. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Sellers. And next we'll have Jan Omasa from the Minnesota Administrators for Special Education. Ms. Omasa.
Thank you, Chair. I need to take a place. Moving. Sorry. We're on fast track. Good morning. My name is Jan Omasa, and I'm the Executive Director for the Minnesota Administrators for Special Education. And with me today is Kim Gibbons, who is the President-elect for MACE and is also the Executive Director for St. Croix River Education District. And first 4 minutes will be Kim talking about research and evidence-based, and I would like to end with adequate funding for special education.
Would you state your name, Kim?
Good morning. My name is Dr. Kim Gibbons. Thank you for allowing us some time today to talk with you about evidence-based practices. This is an important topic for MACE and is a large portion of our legislative platform today. Today, I just want to briefly talk to you about a research-based framework that has a large effect size on student achievement. I just want to start out by saying, when we talk about what works in education, the answer is just about everything works. Most everything we do will give some impact on student achievement. But the real question that we're interested in is what works best, because we only have a short amount of time each school year with students, and we want to make sure that we're using practices that are really accelerating growth to the highest degree possible. So what we do commonly when we're trying to figure out what works best is we look at the results of research studies and we look at effect sizes. And effect sizes are a way that we can compare the results across a number of different research studies. Effect sizes of 1 are quite rare in education. And if you have an effect size of 1, that means that you're advancing achievement by about 2 to 3 years. Effect sizes below 0 are not good. Those are things that not only does it not result in increased student achievement, it makes kids worse and makes their causes a regression in academic achievement. So the practice that I wanted to talk with you about today is the response to intervention framework. It has an effect size of 1.09 in the research literature. Very high effect size. It's most recently being referred to at the federal level as a multi-tiered system of supports, MTSS. At its core, RTI involves 3 components. The first is data, measurement, screening all kids regularly, both on the academic side and the behavioral side, and seeing which kids are at risk, and then targeting and providing tiers of support for kids that need more support. So we have the core instruction that all kids get, and then we know that some kids are going to need something extra, and we provide what's called Tier 2 or supplemental interventions and support. And then we know that even if we provide supplemental instruction, some kids are going to even need more, something more individualized, something more intensive. So we screen all of our kids to figure out what types of supports they need, and then the kids that we identify as at risk, we progress monitor their performance academically and behaviorally regularly. When we look at the effect size of frequent progress monitoring or formative evaluation, has an effect size of 0.9. So again, very large effect size on student achievement. In terms of MACE and what we're promoting is we really believe that Minnesota needs to provide incentives for districts to implement the RTI framework. We believe that Minnesota educators need to have access to high-quality professional development and coaching. The governor released his proposed budget and included funding for regional centers of excellence, which right now are targeted towards Title I schools or schools that are in need of improvement. MACE really believes that at least one or two of these centers should be focused on implementation of an RTI framework, both for academics and behavior, with high-quality coaching and professional development. So with that, I'm going to turn it over to Jan just to briefly review our platform.
Chair and
Thank
committee.
You, Dr. Gibbon.
Yes.
Mr. Hermosa.
Chair and committee members, as you know, MACE is an organization that builds leaders on behalf of advocating for students with disabilities and their families. So we are before you today to request your support for special education funding, which is adequate, equitable, predictable, and sustainable. As you know, over the past decades, the funding partnership between federal, state, and local dollars has been inequitable. The federal government, since 1975, has not kept their commitment and promise for the 40% funding. And over the past decade, the state of Minnesota has moved from 100% proration to 83% proration, which, as you can see, is impacting our local school districts at over 50% of the cost of special education. This is a huge dilemma for us, and you know it as the cross-subsidy. And we need to address this dilemma of the cross-subsidy in order to support our students with disabilities. We need to be equitable because as we look at the maintenance of effort clause in the federal responsibility, we need to figure out how do we maintain that fiscal responsibility from one year to the next. And we as districts are held accountable and responsible. How is the state held accountable and responsible for that same maintenance of effort and that partnership that we need to have together? MACE is also requesting predictability in the funding formula. We don't know what we're going to get and how we will be able. And as we see over the course of the past decade, we have seen increasing, complex, multiple needs of our kids, both academically and emotionally. And it doesn't mean that the student has just one special education teacher. They have a speech pathologist, and they have an occupational therapist, and they have a developmental adaptive phy-ed person, and they have a social worker, and they have a psychologist who's doing reassessments to determine eligibility. All of those multiple needs are increasing for our students, and we need to figure out a way to support that in an equitable way. We also request that it be sustainable. We request that over the past decades we've been struggling with continuous cuts. Directors have been cutting over the past decade, and it's a cumulative effect, and it has a huge impact on the quality and quantity of services that we are able to offer to our students. So we ask you today to please consider, as you look at fully funding special education, to address the cross-subsidies for all of our students across the state. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Hermosa. Next, we have Kathy Saltzman from representing Students First. Ms. Saltzman.
There, and thank you, Mr. Chair. It's an honor to be here today, having served on this committee for 4 years. I know you have heard a lot of information, so what I'm going to try to do is set apart what makes Students First a little different than other organizations. I became the state director in October. We have been active in the state for over a year. We are a national organization. We are active in 17 states, Minnesota being one of them. And why are we active in states? Because that's where we believe that the true reform can happen on a state level to have the most impact. The one thing that we are going to do as we look at policies is we're going to look at how they impact students first. And so we know that there are adults who have issues, and there are school districts, and there are boards, and there are businesses, and there are all different sorts of interest groups. But we're going to look at policies and financing in terms of what's best for students. And we'll continue to raise that with you. We believe, as you look at your handout, that great teachers have a tremendous difference on students of every background. And having a great teacher in front of every classroom is so very, very important. We understand the importance of that. We support that. And that's why when we look at some of our pillar policies, we are so interested in doing what we can to elevate the teaching profession. We also believe that every child, regardless of their zip code, deserves to attend a great school, and all families should have quality school options available to them. In our state, we have great choice. We have great public schools. We have a great charter school system. We have open enrollment. We have PSEO. We have a number of different choices. We have to make sure that all of those choices are high quality, and that's why as we look at our Empower Parents pillar, we'll be looking at how we can elevate our charter schools to make sure that they are high performing, to have accountability, and also to replicate those that are most successful, because we believe that parents need to have great choices in order for them to be involved. We also believe that public dollars belong where they make the biggest difference, and on effective instructional programs. We want to look at policies that have become part of the status quo, rules and regulations that are holding great educators and great school leaders back from doing what they need to do to address the achievement gap. So as you turn your piece over and look at here in Minnesota specifically, we released a state policy report card earlier this year, I think the day before session. It had a lot of spirited conversation, I will say. And we received a D. And I think there was a lot of pushback from that because people said, this is Minnesota. We don't get Ds. But this report card was not about our students. It wasn't about our teachers, our state, anything. It was about looking at a group of policies that are in our policy agenda. There are about 37 of them. And where do we rate in terms of implementing those? So when you look at the agenda here for 2013 in Minnesota, these are hand-selected by our Minnesota team of what makes sense in Minnesota. So we'll be going over those just in a second. The one thing I also want to address is our achievement gap, and I know all of you care deeply about that. What's hard in Minnesota is that we do have great test scores for some kids. We have wonderful ACT scores. We have schools that do well. We have, you know, schools that are doing great things. Please never forget that achievement gap. That should be something that is hovering over this table the entire session. I was in Washington, D.C., and heard Condoleezza Rice speak about a national security report that she's been involved in, and looking at how the achievement gap is affecting our national security. It's an issue of economic competitiveness in Minnesota. It's a social justice issue. It's something that this committee can never forget. And it's something that, as we believe also, to look at policies, to have those hard conversations, those to ask the difficult questions of where does this policy sit in terms of closing the achievement gap and putting students first. In that regard, I'm asking you on this session, along with other groups, is that how can we save our great Minnesota teachers? And that means looking at flexible staffing decisions. I know that other groups have talked about looking at things other than just seniority in how we place teachers so that it's not just an issue in layoffs, but, you know, for school leaders, that they have the ability to place teachers in the best place when it comes to putting the best teacher in front of a given classroom. So having that discussion, we really want to work with you and work with our teachers union on that as well. In terms of evaluations, why do we want great evaluations? So we can make a good teacher a great teacher. To find a young teacher who needs development to help them, to mentor them. We want a strong, robust, and meaningful evaluation system. We want to make sure that the evaluators are qualified and trained. We want to make sure that schools have what they need in order to make those evaluations work, and that it needs to be equitable. We are very much aware that some districts have QCOMP, some districts don't, and some districts will be offered additional dollars in the governor's proposal. But how is that equitable? In terms of forced placement, while this evaluation system is going through, we know that when a child has an ineffective teacher, and I want to be clear, we believe there are many great teachers in Minnesota, but for those who are ineffective, they have an impact on kids. And when a child has an ineffective teacher for 1 year, it's very hard for them to catch up. If they happen to be the child that has an ineffective teacher for 2 years in a row, they may never catch up. So while our evaluation system is being put in place, what can we do as a state to guarantee a parent that their child will not have an ineffective teacher? Can we require school districts to make sure that as they place teachers in classroom, as they place students in classrooms, they are not placed with an ineffective teacher for the 2 years in a row? In charter school reform, this committee, and I was the chief author of our 2009 charter school reform bill, and we did great things. We did great things in Minnesota. We have one of the strongest charter school laws in the country now. But we also said, let us not forget that we should go back every year and make that even a stronger law. And in that regard, let's make sure that charter schools that are working are really doing amazing things with kids, particularly those who are in poverty, who struggle with the achievement gap, that we do everything we can to fast-track the replication of those schools. If you have not been to some of these charter schools, I hope that your chairs will encourage you to go, because I learned a lot as a senator in appreciating the value of charter schools. At the same time, we have charter schools that just aren't doing so well. And just having a charter school doesn't mean it's a better school, that we need to have high-performing charter schools. And so I would encourage you to look at policies that will look at having stronger closure provisions and also accountability for those schools who are at the lowest level. And you'll be hearing about that next, I think, from our next speaker. Spending wisely, we appreciate the governor's proposal. We need to look at investments in education, but we need to also make sure that school districts have greater flexibility in how they use those dollars. So we appreciate the governor's proposal to, again, give greater flexibility to school districts so that they can put the dollars where they think they can get the best results and then hold them accountable. So a system that links expenditures to academic achievement would be very much appreciated. And with that, Madam Chair, I will close. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Ms. Saltzman, for your testimony. At this point, we would like to hear from Elaine Keith. Thank you.
Madam Chair and members, my name is Elaine Keefe, and I'm actually going to be wearing three hats. I promised Ms. Elling that I was not going to take the full 8 minutes that she wanted us to limit ourselves to for each group. I'll try to be more efficient than that. The first group I'm going to talk about is the Minnesota School Nutrition Association, and I think their issue paper is being handed out right now. The Minnesota School Nutrition Association, our members are the cafeteria cooks, the servers, the dietitians who work very hard in your K-12 schools to serve great meals to kids every day. And we take our mission of providing good nutrition to those kids very seriously. It has a big impact on their academic achievement. We have three items on our platform this year. By far and away, our top priority is a funding increase for school lunch. The state currently provides 12 cents for every lunch that we serve. We're asking for a 2-cent increase for that to be raised to 14 cents per lunch. We haven't had an increase in 6 years, and as you might imagine, our costs have gone up during that time, and particularly this year because we are implementing a brand new meal pattern that is required by the federal government, where we're serving more whole grains, more fresh fruits and vegetables, and is considerably more expensive. And so we would hope that we would have your support on that. The gap between the cost of producing a school lunch and what we get in revenues from the federal government, the state government, and what we can collect from families is 30 cents for every lunch that we serve. We make that up by selling a la carte items, but the ability to sell a la carte items to make up that gap is diminishing. And later this year, we are expecting a new federal competitive foods rule that will severely restrict our ability to sell foods that will make up that gap. And so whatever you can do to help us with that would be very, very much appreciated. And we'll look forward to talking to you about that later on in session. School breakfast is also a very important program. It is mandated in any school building where 33% or more of the lunches are served free or reduced. And statewide now, last year, 43% of all the lunches that we served were free or reduced. And so you can see that a majority of the school buildings in the state are required to have a school breakfast program. We think this is a very valuable program. There's all sorts of great evidence to show that kids who eat school breakfast have higher test scores, fewer discipline problems. They go to the school nurse less often. It seems, I think, like common sense, but we also have great evidence to back that up. And we're asking that that funding just be maintained at the current level. And then the last item on our platform is that we have a strongly support farm-to-school programs. We, frankly, kept this rather vague. We were hoping, and our hopes were realized, that there would be some money in the governor's budget for farm-to-school. You'll be happy to hear that it's in the ag budget, so you don't even have to fund it, but schools will benefit. There is a pot of money that is broadly used for a lot of ag promotion, but a chunk of it is going to be set aside for promoting farm to school, and we're very happy about that. So that's the School Nutrition Association. My next group is the Coalition for Children with Disabilities. And this is a coalition of seven organizations that work together on special education issues. Very quickly, the seven organizations are the PACER Center, the Minnesota Disability Law Center, the Epilepsy Foundation, the International Dyslexia Association, the Brain Injury Association, the Autism Society, and the Minnesota Organization on Fetal Alcohol Syndrome. So that gives you a sense of who we are. And we have four items on our agenda. The first is special education funding, stable and adequate funding. I think you heard good testimony about that from Jan Ormassa from MACE, so I won't repeat it here. We're very happy with what's in the governor's budget, the increased funding for special ed. We do have some questions, and we'll be looking closely at the new funding formula that has been proposed that came out of the Education Finance Working Group and is included in the governor's budget. Restrictive procedures, this is an issue for those of you who were here the last couple of years. It has been somewhat contentious. There was comprehensive legislation passed several years ago to regulate the use of restrictive procedures, and that went into effect in August of 2011. We're still working through making sure that school district staff are trained and that these are being used appropriately and that our children are safe. One issue that is ongoing, and that is the use of prone restraint. And this is the practice of placing a student face down on the floor and holding that student down. It's only to be used under current law in emergency situations. That ability to use that procedure is scheduled to be sunsetted in August of this year, and we would like that sunset to go forward and for this procedure not to be used in the future. I'm sure especially those of you who are on the policy committee will be hearing more about that this session. There is a report forthcoming from the Department of Education on this topic. The next item is just special education in Minnesota, upholding our historically strong system of laws and rules. We want to make sure that parents and students' rights are protected, and we'll be keeping a close eye on that, especially to see what the legislative auditor recommends in the report that's going to be due out next month. And then the last issue is bullying, and I'm sure you're all familiar with this. This has been, again, a big issue. I know legislation will be forthcoming this session. We're strongly in support of that. Children with disabilities are disproportionately the targets of bullying, and so this is an issue that is near and dear to our hearts, and we would like to see our current law strengthened. And then my last group, am I talking fast enough, is the Minnesota Library Association. And actually, this is a joint platform. It's the Minnesota Library Association and the Minnesota Educational Media Organization. The first group is all kinds of libraries. The Minnesota Educational Media Organization is specifically for school media programs. So it's your school librarians and your school technology staff that are members of that group. And we have worked together and had a joint platform for many, many years. The first three programs listed are all programs that we're simply asking for current level funding for, and the governor's budget does retain this funding. Very quickly, the first one is Regional Public Library Basic System Support. That's funding that goes to the 12 regional public library systems in the state. It's sort of the general ed formula for public libraries. And most public library funding actually comes from cities and counties. This funding is used for our 12 regional library systems that do cooperative efforts. So they do interlibrary loan. They fund delivery between libraries so that we can share materials. Most of our regional library systems have one electronic card catalog that's online, so you can search that more efficiently. They do some joint purchasing. They make your dollars go further, and they provide seamless service so that you can check out a book in one library and return it in another, and you don't see that process, but they take care of making sure that it gets to the right place. And that's not just true for books, but for everything. The next item is the multi-county, multi-type regional library systems, and that's a much smaller appropriation. These are seven regional entities whose job it is to coordinate efforts between different kinds of libraries. So not just public libraries, but school libraries, higher ed libraries, specialized libraries like medical libraries and historical society libraries and so forth, to have them work together to provide services. And then the last item in this section of the platform is our telecommunications. And there are two separate appropriations, one for public libraries, which is called Regional Library Telecommunications Aid, and one for schools, which is called Telecommunications Equity Aid. At one point, they were one appropriation, then they were split apart, and I think maybe we've gone through a couple of different iterations. This is the way it is currently. These are both reimbursement appropriations so that schools and public libraries are reimbursed for a portion of their telecommunications costs, and it's really an equity issue because costs vary so much around the state, and it really has to do with accidents of geography more than anything else. And so they get a portion of their costs reimbursed through this. And, of course, that's become our real lifeline. This used to be kind of a cool, cutting-edge technological thing when we first came up with this in the mid-'90s, and now it is absolutely essential. We have two new initiatives that are listed down at the bottom portion of the platform. The first, it's not really a new issue, but it hasn't been done yet, and that's supporting dedicated funding for school technology and library media resources. And one possibility is dedicating the proceeds of the Permanent School Trust Fund for this. There have been bills to do this in the past. We really need a source of funding for this, particularly with the rise of online testing. It puts a great, great strain on schools. The legislative auditor suggested this a number of years ago as a potential funding source, and so that's something that we would support. And then the last item would be a modest appropriation for a homework help system to be available free and online through public libraries statewide. The metro area libraries have this now. Their regional library system has purchased this for all the metro area libraries. We'd like to see this available to students statewide. What it is it's an interactive online service where students can get help with their homework in real time. So it's like an online tutoring service, essentially. And, you know, we think that that would be a valuable thing to have for students statewide. So that's it. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Ms. Keith, for being part of this important conversation. Next, we would like to hear from Al Fan.
Madam Chair, thank you, members of the committee. My name is Al Fan. I'm the executive director for a nonprofit organization called Charter School Partners. We are based in Minneapolis, and we serve charter schools throughout the Twin Cities metro region. I think you've heard from several speakers ahead of me about the significance of our achievement gap in Minnesota, and we want to continue to emphasize that fact that we have not made the kind of gains in the state that we had wanted to several years ago. Our achievement gap continues to be significant. But hopefully you've also heard from several folks that the problem is solvable. There are a number of charter schools now in Minnesota that are actually closing the achievement gap. Specifically, Harvest School in North Minneapolis has demonstrated that they can actually get test scores and test rates, proficiency rates for non-white students above the rates for white majority students. And so not only are they closing the achievement gap, they're actually preparing these kids for college and beyond. So the problem is solvable. We're seeing it locally. We're seeing it in many places around the country, and I fundamentally believe that the solution has to be a combination of both the work that the districts are doing in the schools that are existing today, but also new schools. And we represent a new generation of charter schools, what we continue to call Charters 2.0, because we think that it's time to keep the focus on the highest quality schools and provide great choices for families, not just choice. So we believe the school is the school system is the unit of change in order to create systemic change in the districts and the state. Let me reiterate that we, as a nonprofit, focus a lot of our work on Minneapolis charter schools because we work very closely with a lot of local funders and national funders to provide support to those schools. We also serve schools around the Twin Cities metro. We have 28 partner schools right now that we work with. We're not an association, so we are not a voting association. And we are very selective in the schools we work with the emphasis on supporting and promoting high-quality charter schools. The first thing we have to do as we talk about these schools is identify high quality. And in the handout that hopefully you have, on the third page, there are a series of scatterplot graphs. We have used the Department of Education's recently released accountability metrics, the MMR and the FR, the multiple measures rating and the focus rating, and have plotted all the charter schools and all the district schools in Minneapolis on those two axes. And what you see are schools in the upper right quadrant showing that they are able to deliver MMR and FR scores in the top 40 percentile of the state, not just of the district, but of the entire state. So those are schools in the 60 percentile and above. These are both charters and district. And one of the things that should pop out at you very quickly are how few schools there are in the upper right quadrant. There are a total of 9 schools from the FY12 data. 8 of those are charters. 1 is a district school. And those 9 schools combined only serve about 2,500 of the low-income students in the city. There are about 30,000 low-income students in Minneapolis. Those 9 schools only serve about 2,500. So about 1 in 11, 1 in 12. We've got to create more schools that serve low-income kids. We've got to create more high-quality schools that can get them to grade level and beyond. And that is the work that we do at Charter School Partners. So in order to create, in order to move more schools into the upper right quadrant, we follow a couple of different strategies. One of our key strategies is to incubate new schools in the city. And we do that by working early with leaders that we identify, bring them into a program, and support their development while they open new charter schools. We also don't want to ignore schools that are already doing this work. So we are supporting schools and trying to help them move from good to great. And then as these schools demonstrate great results, like some of our schools are already doing, we work with them to replicate their model and continue to expand their work. Our policy agenda, which is this handout inside your packet, describes our 4 primary goals in doing that. The first and foremost goal for us is to support and defend, I guess, the deal that occurred 20 years ago when Minnesota passed the first charter law, and that was to give schools a high level of autonomy in exchange for a high level of accountability. And I think we have forgotten the accountability piece over the last few years, and we want to put that back into the equation. We have seen, again, schools demonstrate high levels of results, high levels of performance for low-income kids and kids of color, but we also have seen too many schools not delivering on those results. And so we want to emphasize and support laws that will close down these lowest-performing schools in order to free up resources for other schools to do that work and to do it hopefully much, much better. We also believe that with this accountability, again, comes great autonomy, and we would encourage you to consider laws that would allow charter schools that are doing this fantastic work to have greater autonomy in selecting the teachers that they bring into their schools. The current licensure laws are very strong, but they're also very restrictive. And I think what we have seen are that these great leaders know the kind of people they want to bring into their schools. They know what kind of teachers will work best with these students. Let's let them decide what will work best for them and then hold them accountable for those results. And if they don't deliver those results, then we'll have to force them to close. So we believe in this accountability versus autonomy deal. We believe in closing down the lowest performing schools, and we believe in high autonomy for school leaders to pick their own teachers. From a funding standpoint, our emphasis is on this next generation of charter schools, Charters 2.0. We want to create the best charter schools in the country. But in order to do that, these schools need a level of funding stability in their first 5 years. When we have had to work with the shift in the education funding, many of these new schools struggled to get the funding they needed in the first years to operate. And so if we could provide stability for those new schools in their first few years, that would be beneficial to these schools in opening up and allow us to do this work. And then finally, I don't want to ignore the collaboration with the district. We can't do this alone, and we're not proposing that we do this alone. We want to work very closely with the district. Last year we supported, or 2 years ago, we supported the collaboration bill with Minneapolis Public Schools, and we continue to want to work very closely with them so that our work is in line with their strategic plan. But ultimately, we're all about creating the best schools for our children. We don't think there are any excuses left. We know that it can be done, and we will continue to work toward that with your help. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Fan. Next up, we have Jim Grathwell.
Madam Chair, members, my name is Jim Grathwell. I wear one hat. I represent the Minneapolis Public Schools. I thought I'd be batting cleanup, but we'll leave that to Ms. Schwab with Ms. Kelleher with MSBA. So you have our entire legislative agenda in a handout before you, and if we haven't sucked all the oxygen out of the room yet, I think I'd just like to say from a very high level, all the people on this side of the table actually agree. What you've heard is a bunch of agreement. We all want to ensure that all students learn, that they graduate college ready, and when they bring that diploma to their higher education institution, if that's their choice, that it is meaningful. We may disagree a little bit about ways and means to get there, but that's the complexity and beauty of this work. So I want to welcome you to the table and to the work. The agenda you have before you from Minneapolis Public Schools talks about supporting the Commissioner's K-12 Finance Work Group. We also strongly support the Governor's recommendations. I want to commend you, the Governor's recommendations to you as something as a great foundation, a great place to start. We also supported the work group recommendation to reinstitute a general ed levy. New people around the table have inherited this deal that was cut in 2001, implemented in 2003, have the state take over the general education levy. I think it adds great stability back into the system to reinstitute that. Like the Wicked Witch of the West, these things must be done delicately. So that's a tough thing to figure out, and you're going to be working very closely with the tax committee to figure out that sort of thing. But we'd encourage you to look at that. I think the governor's recommendations and the task force recommendations around compensatory revenue reform, rolling in extended time, around integration revenue reform are strong. I just want to point out, last night I spent the evening at Washburn High School, where we had a racial incident. It's reported in the paper. We're not there yet in terms of the, I'll say, racial healing we need to do at that high school in my city, in this state and country. And integration revenue and the integration as a public policy purpose, I believe, is a compelling state interest. I think students and the research shows learn better in racially integrated environments. And I think what we're the most recent report out of our friend Myra Norfield at the Institute of Race and Policy is that some of the tools we're trying to use for integration, choice, actually undermine integration. So we're going to have a full debate on that. I think the governor's budget recommendations are a great place to start. I think the Integration Repurposing Advisory Task Force recommendations are a good place to start. But I just want to highlight that for you. The budget recommendations on LEP revenue, expanding the eligibility for students to generate that revenue. It takes more time, actually, and that five-year cap was put in 2003, again, history, that simply saved the state money and wasn't about the needs of students. We strongly support access to high-quality early childhood. We have gap-closing early childhood programs, and we'd love to show you that data. there's great agreement on early childhood. There's great agreement on all-day kindergarten. There's great agreement on additional funding for special education, all of which, you know, you see addressed in the governor's budget recommendations. There's simplification of funding formulas. In that budget, there's also, you know, a lot of this work happens outside the classroom. School-linked mental health grants in the DHS budget are a very strong piece of the governor's budget recommendation. MSD had a conference this fall where MPS and county employees presented how well mental health services can help close the achievement gap. That's an incredibly important thing for many of the students we serve. I just want to mention, by December 31st in Minneapolis, we had already counted 4,128 homeless, highly mobile students. That's more than 10% of our population. We're in the business of educating students. We feed them. We transport them. Sometimes we clothe them. We take care of their illnesses. We don't do housing. We're going to need partners on that problem. Not so much in this committee, but in Senator Torres Ray's committee, we'll be addressing the grad test reforms. We support the recommendations of the Assessment Advisory Task Force. A lot of great task forces worked over the interim here. Sam Walseth from MREA puts it best, have to move away from this era where one student takes one test on one given day, and that ends their high school career. That denies them a diploma. So I'm going to stand on Sam's shoulders for that piece. Teacher evaluation, Senator Peterson, we think that's a great bill. We've invested heavily in implementing our teacher evaluation program. We think we need to revisit some bits of that. The Teacher Evaluation Advisory Task Force did some good work. We have a recommendation on how we can improve that a little bit further. In terms of charter school policy, it was fitting and appropriate that Mr. Fan and I be seated next together. We're working in partnership, and this committee led last year in advancing our collaborative charter school bill, creating a public policy framework that supports school districts and charter schools working together. I think it works much better like this than if we're competing and fighting. So I really support you as policymakers straightening out the incentives for school districts and charter schools to collaborate. We also have some facilities authorities we'd like to talk to you about renewing, and I think I'll leave it at that and turn it over to Ms. Kelleher, if that suits the chair.
Thank you, Mr. Crosswell.
Thank you.
Next, we have Grace Kelleher.
Thank you, Madam Chairman and members. My name is Grace Kelleher, and I represent the Minnesota School Boards Association. I'll tell you a little bit about myself. I was a school board member in Albert Lee and Austin for 10 years. I was lucky enough to serve on this body and this committee, so I certainly understand the challenges in front of you today. I'm here, and my organization represents elected school board members. No teachers, no superintendents, no other employees, just elected members, very similar to you yourselves going forward. They're charged with managing our schools and dedicate themselves to bringing the best education for kids forward every day. We did our platform a little bit differently this year. We tried to hit on some big things that we thought were missing, and we believe an investment in the student is a smart investment in our state's future. We support funding voluntary all-day, every-day kindergarten. Senate File 2 is a wonderful bill. We've had the opportunity to talk to Senator Claussen and really think this is a home run for kids and encourage you to support that. We want to dedicate funding, as you've heard from my colleagues, on principal and teacher evaluation. That will be enacted, but no funding was there, and we're really challenged to make sure our staff has the skills and talents to be up and ready to do that. We would like to reduce the cross-subsidy in special education. We want to recognize and fund technology needed to implement and enhance school district accountability systems, and you'll see technology coming up a couple times in this piece. We had a technology funding stream about 5 years ago for 2 years of $50 per kid, and that went off. But as you think about your district, things that are transforming in your schools are technology, and there is no funding stream for that on an ongoing basis. So I really challenge you to think about funding those needs, because as we go around the state, we find our 343 school districts across the state talk about needs not only for testing,
but for classroom interaction and for having our staff up to speed on the latest and greatest things for our kids. We also believe we need to assist school districts with their building facility issues. Senator Wieger, about 15 years ago, did a building study of school district needs across the state, and I believe the price tag on that report was about $3 billion. $4 billion to get our state schools all up into the state they need to be. I can tell you that number's probably doubled or tripled since then, and we really would ask your indulgence to think about facilities across the state and what we can do to bring those up to speed. We would like to eliminate the cap on the Safe Schools levy. School boards, unlike city councils and county commissioners, have no levy authority without voter approval. We believe that in this one small place, Safe Schools, making our schools safe, that levy authority should be granted to the school district to provide what we need across the district to make our schools safe. It's going to look different district to district because we're all in different places and we all face different needs. But I really ask you to unbind our hands on this one issue and give school districts the authority to levy to make our schools safe for all kids. We also support providing a provisional teaching license in certain urgent situations. Outstate, we're hearing that in where teachers are hard to get in science or in math, special education, they have to pass a basic series of tests before they can start in the classroom. The turnaround time from the department's been over a month, and oftentimes we, instead of putting that teacher in the classroom, we make those teachers wait and put substitutes in the classroom until their test results come back from the state. So we want some wiggle room to make sure that we're putting kids with their teacher as soon as possible going forward. And we'd like to also talk to you about school start date. It's a tough issue here in Minnesota. We're one of three states in the nation that force our schools to start after Labor Day. We would really appreciate a discussion in Senator Torres-Ray's committee about the need to start school when our superintendents, and Superintendent Carlson next to me is one of our finest in the state, and he should have the ability to call kids and start kids in school when the community and the board feel it's appropriate. Last but not least, we really want you to take a look at that grad test in math, reading, and writing. I served on the assessment committee, the working task force group, and my aha moment came when Minsky said to us, we don't look at your MCA scores, we don't look at your grad test, and we don't look at what the kids take in high school. We put them in the AccuPlacer, and that's how we place them. There is a big disconnect then between K-12 and higher ed. And that grad test, we had testing experts in the other body talk about that this grad test, it's not tied to college readiness. There's no empirical data to tie it to anything. And to say school boards must deny a diploma to a child if they can't pass this test is foolishness, mostly if they have the grades and the local standards to go forward. We'd like to support an accountability system that focuses on student coursework and enriches educational programs. But my word of this year is relevant. We want to make sure programs are relevant to kids, so they're meaningful, and there's great opportunity out there with technology and with programs that kids could get skills where they could actually get good jobs, and it makes school make sense again, and I think we need to really take a look at that. Last but not least, we truly believe that equity needs to be looked at. The disparity across the state is great, and we feel that, you know, $3,000 a child difference can be a huge classroom difference across the state. With that, I appreciate your time. MSBA has been around since 1920, so we've been around a long time. You'll see us a lot in committee. And on the back of our handout, you'll see the other faces of MSBA that will also be in front of you. So, Mr. Chairman, it is a great honor to be in front of you today. And we appreciate your service here, but we really appreciated your service on the board. With that, members, I'll end. Thank you.
Thank you, Grace Kelleher, and welcome to Superintendent Denny Carlson from the Anoka-Hennepin School District, along with Michelle Vargas, the Chief Financial Officer from the Anoka-Hennepin School District. So, welcome.
Mr. Chair, thank you very much for this privilege and honor, and it seems like yesterday when you were serving as a school board member for us, so I very much appreciate being here. Michelle Vargas is our award-winning CFO. She was named one of the most outstanding women in finance this year and CFO of the year in the public sector, so very proud of Michelle's efforts. And thanks again for allowing me to speak on this privileged time. Noke-Hennepin School District is a district that's rapidly changing. I've been there almost three decades. We have one-third of our students are in poverty, and one-fourth of our students are students of color, and those have doubled each of the three decades that I've been in that district. We have the lowest per capita income in the seven-county metro area, and we have the lowest number of adults with a college diploma, one in four. Those are the challenges we have in Anoka-Hennepin. The good news is we graduate 3,000 students every year, more than any single district in the history of the state of Minnesota. If you count our adult basic ed, high school diploma, and GED, we graduate over 3,300 students a year. Among the large school districts in Minnesota, we have the lowest achievement gap, particularly in reading. We have some of the lowest administrative costs in the state, under 3%. We have some of the most effective use of space and facilities. In 2010, Mr. Chair, we closed eight schools so we could remain being efficient. This last year, we've invested highly, strategic investments in early education, all the everyday K, and Senator Peterson, early college. We'd like to have our students graduate from high school with 1 and 2 years of college. That's one of Senator Peterson's initiatives, and we gladly support him in that effort. We like many of the initiatives in the governor's budget. I'll mention two: the continuation of the compensatory pilot with Ms. Dietrich, who used to serve in this legislative body as the person that helped to get us that in 2006. That's critical for us. We need the money and we need the flexibility. If we're going to maintain a low achievement gap in the state, that's how we need to spend that money and have flexibility in our schools in terms of where it goes to the greatest need. We appreciate the special education support. It comes in the second year of the biennium. Our annual cross-subsidy in special ed is $31 million a year. So we take $31 million every year from our general fund to pay for our special education needs. And then finally, it's probably the most important thing I have to say to you, and I said this on NPR yesterday morning, what the state spends in education and what individual school districts get are two very different things. For fiscal year 14, we get $2 million. We need $14 million every year of new money just for inflation. So we get $2 million. We're going to spend about $1 million on our TRA increase. We spend another $500,000 on our anti-bullying efforts. And yesterday I was having lunch with three teachers, and one said to me, "Boy, I saw the governor's budget, and looks like we're doing great." And I said, "Well, not so great in the first year." I said, "We need $14 million. We're getting two, and we've got at least a $12 million deficit." Teacher to my left said, "I've got two choices. I said, I can cut 200 teachers, or we can have a hard freeze for our 13 bargaining groups." And the teacher to my left said, "That'll make the fifth year in a row that I've not received any increase." And so the dilemma for us is, how can we work this out with all the great efforts of the governor and the body of the Senate and House? How can we make this year a good year for all the students in the state of Minnesota? Thank you very much.
Superintendent Carlson and Michelle Vargas, thank you. Did you have anything to add, Michelle, or thank you for being here? Pleasure of the committee. Mr. Chair, I'm going to give it back to you.
Thank you, Senator Hoffman. Thank you, members of the committee, and for many of you sharing in the chairing of the meeting, and there will be additional opportunities at future meetings as well, because we're in this together. This is one Minnesota. We represent our districts, and we will passionately share our concerns, but we have heard today the variety of perspectives, and as you well know, we will come up with a proposal eventually, hope, and we will have disagreements, but ultimately it's the one Minnesota that's represented here in the room today. For announcements, we have the next committee meeting next week. I believe it'll be Thursday. We've been told to hold the full finance committee open, and so we're waiting to see if there might be a meeting prior to that. So I'm not able to schedule anything prior to that. Tentatively, though, and it'll be confirmed today, we will meet next Thursday. The all-day kindergarten proposal will be before us. I believe there's another related proposal on perhaps a bit more flexibility potentially that one member is developing. And if anyone else has a related item on that and you have a bill that's in the hopper, let me know. And beyond that, there's just been a few introductions for our jurisdiction so far. I've talked to different offers about that, and let me know on scheduling issues, et cetera. We do have a couple of other items scheduled out for later, and I can share that with you as we get closer to that date. I want to commend all the testifiers. You did a great job. We appreciate your compassion, your being so succinct as well in putting it together. And I know that's difficult, but you communicated very effectively. If you could, we would appreciate to have an electronic link for the handout. If you do have that, please send it to the committee, and we'd be happy to post that on the website or something so we can provide additional transparency. I wanted to note that on the agenda today, it had said to be announced, and we had announced to the committee what we were going to do, but it did not get on the formal agenda that we wish we would have had that. And in transition, et cetera, we will make sure that as we have future meetings posted, that will all be included. And so just wanted to give you the heads up. I did talk to Senator Nienau about that. So those will be announcements. And again, want to thank you. Thank all the testifiers. And if there's anyone else that not here that is in the viewing audience that would potentially like to share something, let us know. And we do know that you are setting up meetings with us individually as well as in our districts. We appreciate that. And with those announcements and gratitude on behalf of the committee for everyone's thoughtful participation, we're adjourned.